Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Willie, Harry, Stee, Harry, Dick, John, Harry, 3, 1, 2, 3, Neds, Richard, 2, Henry's, 4, 5, 6, then who? Edward, 4, 5, Dick the Bad, Harry's, Twain, and Ned the Lad, Mary, Bessie, James the Vain, Charlie, James again, William and Mary, Anna Gloria, 4 Georges, William and Victoria. Yes, Queen Victoria, she sits there like this kind of massive monumental lump of rock. For a huge chunk of the 19th century and into the 20th. And she is definitely one of those monarchs who I can safely assume that you all have some kind of an idea of, or an image of, in your minds. She was our first monarch to be photographed, and she was also our first monarch to be filmed. There is documentary footage of her Diamond Jubilee, which you can see on YouTube. She's a blob, essentially, sitting in an open carriage under a big white parasol. But there she is, preserved forever as a ghost made of light. She's an old woman in this footage, nearly 80 years old, and she'd been on the throne for 60 years. That is a long reign, so there's a lot to fit in, which means this is going to be quite a long episode, but a fascinating one. Queen Victoria. And yes, like many of our monarchs, she is also someone who is being constantly reassessed, seen in a new light. I think when I was a kid, the image of Queen Victoria was this sour-faced, dumpy, little old woman dressed in black with a little white bonnet on the top, utterly miserable the whole time. And her catchphrase was, "We are not amused." And that seems to be something that she never said. And certainly in her younger days, she was very amused. She laughed a lot. She enjoyed parties and having a good time. The reason for the black was that she spent half her life in mourning for her husband, Prince Albert, which we will come on to. And there was this idea that the Victorians were terribly prudish and ill-informed sexually, that Victoria never brought in any legislation about lesbianism because she didn't believe such a thing existed. There were all these ideas around. Oh, and the idea that she put little dresses round table legs because it wasn't decent to show your legs. Most of this is, as so much of our common knowledge of history is, bollocks. It's true the Victorian era was rife with hypocrisy. There were public morals, which the great men and women were always trying to show that they had, and the politicians making great speeches about it. And we know that in private, people behaved just as badly as they've always done and always will do. Gladstone, one of the main prime ministers in the Victorian era, became obsessed with prostitution. He would roam the streets at night looking for sex workers, who he would spend hours with, trying to save them from their ways. And he got so turned on by the process and filled with self-disgust as a result that he would rush home and whip himself in private for sexual gratification. And that perhaps sums up the idea of Victorianism. And we see the era as being just this one unchanging thing. But Victoria changed massively through her reign, and the country changed massively too. It was a period of industrial, scientific, military, political development within the United Kingdom, partly fuelled by the massive growth of the British Empire. And so much of our modern attitudes of how we look at ourselves and think of ourselves seem to have been forged in the Victorian era. We've looked at it several times through the series, how there was a sudden reinterest in history and tradition and looking back into the past, particularly into the Middle Ages. And a lot of these sort of forgotten traditions were reintroduced or reinvented. We have a growth of neo-Gothic architecture. We have a lot of weird semi-medieval pantomime ceremony in royal events and in coronations. And there was a great growth in historical fiction and an invention of a sort of romantic past of chivalry and lords and ladies in elegant dress. And most of it, as I say, is invented. We've been through the Middle Ages in this series, and it was not a romantic time of courtly dignity. It was full of violence and bloodshed and horror. But in recent years, the image of Queen Victoria has changed. I think probably the first example of that was the film Mrs. Brown, where Judi Dench played Queen Victoria for the first time. She played her later on in a film about her Indian servant, who she had a similar relationship to as she did with John Brown, as played by Billy Connolly in the film. This idea that she had fallen so far into depression following Albert's death that she was unable to function. And she went to her house in Balmoral, and her Scottish manservant there, a sort of rough, gilly type, a man of the country, pulled her out of it. "Oh, stop this stuff and nonsense, Mrs. Brown. It's time to get out and face the world again." And we see her as more of a human being. It's very interesting that the plot of that film is very similar to the, well, at least the story arc of The Queen, the film for which Helen Mirren won her Oscar, playing Queen Elizabeth II. And the idea there is that she needs to come out and connect with the people, that she has become too reclusive. In fact, she's become too reclusive on her estate in Balmoral. And Tony Blair says to her, you know, "You're in danger of being overshadowed by Princess Diana, the people's princess, who has died, and you don't seem to be as cut up about it as you should. Forget this stiff upper lip nonsense." So, well, actually, I suppose in a way it's a sort of opposite story arc, that Mrs. Brown, Queen Victoria, is shown as being too emotional, too tied up in her depression and her despair. And in Queen Elizabeth, she's not emotional enough. But the solution in both problems is to reconnect with her public. Queen Elizabeth as the mother of the people, Queen Victoria as the grandmother of the people. And more recently than Mrs. Brown, we have had two portrayals of Victoria as a young woman. This idea that before Albert died, she was this outgoing, fun-loving person. I mean, she came to the throne when she was a teenager. She was only 18. We had the film with Emily Blunt, written by Julian Fellowes, who wrote, of course, Downton Abbey. And here we see young Victoria as this glamorous, willful, romantic, beautiful young woman. Now, I don't want to get into talking too much about people's beauty or otherwise, but let's just say that Queen Victoria was no Emily Blunt. Neither was she a Jenna Coleman. J. Jenna Coleman was at least slightly closer to Queen Victoria's height of 4'11". But again, Jenna is a very radiant beauty in a way that Queen Victoria was not. But in this film and this TV series, we see Queen Victoria as a young person before she falls into mourning, before she becomes that elderly black widow. And in both of these portrayals of her, her relationship with Albert is presented as this great romantic love story. I think in the series of Victoria with Jenna Coleman, I think it does start to explore problems with the marriage, but it's very interesting, their relationship, and I will come on to that in a minute. And sorry, I have given a very long introduction to this episode, but I think the bottom line is Queen Victoria was a person. Not just a figurehead, a monument to empire, a stern face on the coinage, a caricature. She started out as a child. She was a young woman. Then she was an older woman. She was a middle-aged woman. And she was an old woman. And we need to see her in all those aspects of her life and take all of those periods of her life seriously. So as I say, she was no Emily Blunt. And particularly as she got older, her distinctive Hanoverian features began to get more pronounced. The little bulging eyes, the small mouth, the prominent nose in the sort of egg-like round face. And in the earliest known photograph of her, taken with her eldest daughter, Princess Victoria, who was always called Vicky, Queen Victoria was only 26 years old. The photograph was taken in 1845. But if you look at it, she looks about 40. But, you know, it's interesting that there's a photograph at all. I definitely feel with Queen Victoria that we are entering the modern age. We are entering a more recognisable part of history. And everyone knows that before Queen Elizabeth II, she was our longest reigning monarch by a long chalk. She ruled for 63 years and died aged 81. And one of the main reasons she was one of our longest reigning monarchs was because she was so young when she came to the throne. If you listened to the last episode, you will have heard how her uncle, her wicked uncle, one of her several wicked uncles, King William IV, had been on the throne. He had come to the throne very late in life because his oldest brother, George IV, had no children of his own. The next brother had died, so William came to the throne in his 60s. So he didn't have much of a chance to reign very long. He managed to have no legitimate children, and thus Queen Victoria came to the throne. I suppose the big central issue of her reign was the massive growth and consolidation of the British Empire, particularly in India. And we will look at how India had been run essentially by a private corporation, the East India Company. But during Victoria's reign, the British crown took over and she had herself crowned Empress of India,
which in 1876 became her official title when the then Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli pushed the Royal Titles Act through Parliament.
And there were various colonial wars during her reign, particularly the Crimean War in the 1850s, and the two Boer Wars, the second of which, like Victoria herself, straddled the start of the 20th century. There were also the Anglo-Zulu Wars, the Indian Mutiny, war in Afghanistan, Egypt, China, even New Zealand.
The two wars with China were particularly interesting and shine quite a light on the workings of the empire. These wars became known as the Opium Wars, and I mean, it's quite complicated, but I'll try to simplify it. Essentially, China had a lot of stuff that we wanted, spices, silk, tea, porcelain, whatever, but we didn't have anything that they really much wanted. And it was not good trading practice to send empty ships to China, which then came back laden with Chinese goods. China was also a very closed society. They wanted to keep the West out and didn't want free trade with us. So the Western powers, including Britain, sent in gunboats and armies to force China to trade with them and to force them to accept opium, which we were now shipping in vast quantities from India and the Middle East. to fill our boats up and make it a viable trade. This is quite different to the modern concept of the war on drugs. We were forcing them into drug addiction for our own profit. The Chinese Navy and military were no match for the more developed Western forces. And during both wars, the Chinese were defeated and forced to accept pretty punishing terms, including giving Hong Kong to the British.
Now, I'm not going to go into any great detail about this side of things. I think what I need to do is a whole separate episode about the British Empire so that we can look at the development of that and what happened during Victoria's reign. I think I'm going to concentrate more on the personal side of Queen Victoria, because also the other thing is she didn't particularly get involved in politics. Politics was going on all around her. But for one reason or another, mainly because she was pretty prudent and saw that in order to keep her throne, she needed to not look like a meddling monarch, she largely kept out of things. Victoria had to learn the gentle touch, the art of having a quiet word. And Queen Elizabeth II seemed to model herself so much on Victoria, this idea that she would meet her prime ministers and she would have a head-to-head with them, a little chat, and she would scrupulously not tell them what to do, but she would try to gently guide them and advise them based on her long period of having been in that position, of having met all these prime ministers and seen them come and go. It's very much the same in Victoria's era. There's several prime ministers. There's Lord Melbourne, there's Palmerston, there's Robert Peel, who invented the first police force, named after him as the Peelers. There was Gladstone, and there was a famous Gladstone bag named after him, this leather bag that opened into two sections. And then there was Benjamin Disraeli, after whom the board game Dizzy Dizzy Dinosaur was named. No, it wasn't. I don't think anything was named after Disraeli. But yes, he was nicknamed Dizzy. And I talked way back about the idea of the monarch being the sort of head of state, the representative for the nation. And certainly when you get monarchs who have a certain amount of common sense, like Victoria and Queen Elizabeth II, their role as an advisor, as a steadying hand, can be very, very useful. One of her biographers, Lytton Strachey, writing in the 20s, described her as small and forthright. And he said, it was her sincerity which gave her at once her impressiveness, her charm, and her absurdity. She moved through life with the imposing certitude of one to whom concealment was impossible, either towards her surroundings or herself. Her full name was Alexandrina Victoria. She doesn't seem to have ever really liked the Alexandrina and insisted when she became queen of being called Victoria. And I mentioned in passing in the previous episode that Victoria was a newfangled German import. It was considered not a particularly attractive name, and it was considered a bit sort of, well, it's just not British. It's a little bit showy-offy, isn't it? It's a little bit blowing one's own trumpet, Victoria.
Now, of course, it's considered a very traditional English name. And, you know, if she'd kept the name of Alexandrina, that would probably be now considered an ordinary English name. The pub in EastEnders, our long-running London-based soap opera, wouldn't be called the Queen Vic. It would be called the Queen Alexandrina, or perhaps the Queen Alex.
So, Victoria, and I do find it funny that her daughter was called Vicky. It sounds so very modern, but the name became popular because of the Queen. Sorry, every time I get going, I distract myself, but there you go. There's so much to say about Victoria, not least of which the huge number of children she had, grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
She had 87 great-grandchildren, and she became known as the Grandmother of Europe, because so many members of her family ended up on European thrones. Not just the United Kingdom, there was Russia, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Spain, Greece.
In the First World War, Tsar Nicholas, Kaiser Wilhelm and George V were all descendants of Victoria. They were all first cousins. So it's this extraordinary thing where you have these countries fighting each other, and it's like a sort of family feud in some ways.
Right, so let's get back to basics and start at the beginning. Victoria's father, Edward, the Duke of Kent, the fourth son of King George III, died in January 1820.
When Victoria was less than a year old, so she never really knew him. And a week later, her grandfather, King George III, died as well, to be succeeded by his eldest son, George IV,
who died with no surviving legitimate children, as did our next king, George's younger brother, William IV, which meant that it was clear that Victoria was going to ascend to the throne.
And we saw in the last episode how King William had grown to distrust Victoria's mother, the Duchess of Kent, Princess Victoria. He seemed to dislike the fact that Victoria, the Duchess of Kent, was behaving as if she was the Queen Mother before William had actually died. She sort of took her daughter Victoria on a procession around the country, showing her off, and she started acting with all these airs and graces, and William came to hate her more and more and vowed not to die until young Victoria was 18 years old, so that the Duchess of Kent would never become regent. Now, during Princess Victoria's childhood, her mother treated her extremely strictly, and a man called Sir John Conroy, who was rumoured quite heavily to be the Duchess's lover, helped the Duchess put together this very strict system called the Kensington system for bringing up Victoria to be queen. She was heavily cosseted. She was not allowed to do anything by herself. She slept in her mother's bedroom, and Conroy and the Duchess completely controlled her to an extent that Princess Victoria really hated Conroy, and she grew to hate her mother, who prevented her from seeing anybody who she didn't want her to see, and tried to keep her weak and dependent. And it seems that young Princess Victoria's only friends were her dolls and her King Charles Spaniel Dash. Inevitably, people were trying to make plans for her marriage. Her mother was, John Conroy was, and particularly her uncle Leopold, the King of the Belgians, seemed to have quite a strong influence on her. He decided that she should marry Prince Albert, her first cousin, the son of his brother Ernest, the Duke of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. And Victoria travelled to Coburg to meet Albert. They seemed to hit it off. She seemed to like him a lot. She considered him very good looking. She wrote, and in fact, Victoria wrote extensive journals and letters all her life, which are a great insight into the workings of her mind. Unfortunately, her daughter Beatrice, after Victoria died, went through the whole lot and edited them and took out probably the most interesting stuff. But Victoria wrote of Albert when they first met that he is extremely handsome. His hair is about the same colour as mine. His eyes are large and blue, and he has a beautiful nose and a very sweet mouth with fine teeth. But the charm of his countenance is his expression, which is most delightful. And not long after meeting Albert, she famously wrote in her diary about a very momentous day. I was awoke at 6 o'clock by Mamma, who told me the Archbishop of Canterbury and Lord Conyngham were here and wished to see me. I got out of bed and went into my sitting room, only in my dressing gown, and alone, and saw them. Lord Conyngham then acquainted me that my poor uncle the King was no more, and had expired at 2:12 this morning, and consequently that I am Queen. The first thing she did when she was made queen was to get rid of Conroy. She said she didn't want to see him anymore and he was to stay out of her presence. It was insisted that her mother had to remain at court because of Victoria's age and had to live in the royal household. Victoria was the first monarch to actually live in Buckingham Palace, which she did, but she kept her mother confined to an obscure wing and Conroy skulked around there, trying to keep out of Queen Victoria's sight. At the time she became queen, she was only 18. She didn't know very much about running a country, working with Parliament. So she worked very closely with the Prime Minister, Lord Melbourne, who was a Whig. He was a Liberal. And the two of them got on very well and were very close. He helped her enormously to understand everything that was going on. he advised her, he updated her on everything, and she lent on him more and more. It's interesting that Victoria had no father and Melbourne had no daughters. So there was a sort of father and daughter relationship. I think in the Jenna Coleman Victoria series, there's a hint that might be a romance between the two of them. I think a father-daughter relationship seems much more likely. Victoria's coronation took place in June 1838 at Westminster Abbey, and over 400,000 visitors came to London for the celebrations. And this was the biggest crowd that London had ever known. And they were brought into the city by the railroads, this fairly new innovation. People were able to travel relatively fast and relatively inexpensively now. And this was one of the things that was massively changing the country.
So the streets were thronged and Westminster Abbey was thronged. They had to put up all this stadium-style seating to accommodate all these foreign dignitaries, heads of state, kings and queens.
And they were determined that after a series of botched coronations where things had gone wrong, that Victoria's would go smoothly. But unfortunately, they didn't really have time to properly rehearse it. And a lot of things went wrong.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, William Howley, was in charge of proceedings. But right from the off, he never seemed to quite know what was supposed to happen next. And Victoria struggled to keep up. The whole thing lasted over 5 hours and must have been a bit of an ordeal for all concerned.
And when he came to put the ring on, he tried to put it on the wrong finger and it didn't fit. And he quite badly hurt Queen Victoria, and it took her some time to get the ring off afterwards. An elderly peer called Lord Roll, who was in his 80s, was helped up the steps to kiss Queen Victoria's ring, as all the lords had to at the time. But as he neared the top of the steps, he slipped out of the hands of the people holding him up. He fell down and he rolled all the way to the bottom. And Victoria jumped up and she sort of rushed over to meet him halfway so he didn't have to come all the way back up to the top, which everybody thought was a lovely gesture. But afterwards, of course, there was a lot of merriment at the idea of Lord Roll rolling down the steps. A guy called Richard Barham wrote a poem about it called Mr. Barney Maguire's Account of the Coronation, which includes these lines: "Then the trumpets braying and the organ playing and the sweet trombones with their silver tones, but Lord Roll was rolling. 'Twas mighty consoling to think his lordship did not break his bones." Yes, he does seem to have been all right. It's interesting there that he describes the music as sounding quite good, but because the general opinion at the time was that it was awful. It was all over the place and out of tune. It's another of the things that went wrong. St. Edward's Chapel, off to the side, had been set up as a sort of holding pen for members of the royal family so that they could retire there if they got too tired, as the ceremony was going on so long. And apparently the altar was set up with sort of sandwiches and drinks, so like a sort of snack bar. The Archbishop never quite knew what was going on, and at one point declared that the whole thing was over. Queen Victoria went into the chapel and she was hastily brought back. He'd skipped several pages in his manual and had to come back and carry on.
Which must have been heart-sinking for everybody involved. And then at the end of the service, the treasurer of the household, Lord Surrey, threw these silver coronation medals into the crowd, which caused a small riot as everybody fought each other to get their hands on one.
But once Victoria was queen, she had a pretty lively court. She had lots of balls and dances and dinners. She enjoyed parties. She was young. She was a teenager. She was having, in many ways, the time of her life. She was described as laughing a lot, although a couple of men complained that she showed her teeth and her gums too much. So things were going pretty good. She was very, very popular amongst the people of Britain. I mean, if you can imagine, we've had Mad King George, who no one saw very much of. Then we had George the Fourth, this sort of philandering, obese playboy. Then we had King William, who was a very old man when he came to the throne and quite irascible. And now we have this young, radiant 18-year-old on the throne, and everyone was saying this is going to be such a different palace. It's going to be fun and feminine. But barely a year after Victoria was crowned, there was a huge scandal at court, which became known as the Hastings Affair. One of her mother's cohorts, a young Lady Flora Hastings, had been part of the old regime, the Kensington system, who had treated Victoria so harshly when she was young. Victoria had never liked her, and as I say, she had never liked Sir John Conroy, who was her mother's right-hand man. And Lady Flora Hastings started to show signs of being pregnant, and rumours went round that this was an out-of-wedlock pregnancy caused by Sir John Conroy, and Victoria stoked these rumours. She hated Conroy. She hated that odious Lady Flora. And this became a big scandal at court, that this unmarried woman should be pregnant. But she refused to be medically examined, saying it was undignified and that this was an imposition on her, and she was right. But eventually she had to give in, and it was discovered that she was a virgin and that this abdominal growth must be something else. She still wouldn't allow them to examine her properly, and she died not long afterwards, and the post-mortem showed that she had a large tumour on her liver that had caused her abdomen to be swollen. So Victoria didn't come out of this looking very good at all. She had falsely accused Flora of behaving badly. She'd falsely accused Sir John Conroy. And, you know, some people were saying she'd hounded this poor young woman to death. And when she went out in public, people jeered at her and hissed and called her Mrs. Melbourne, because Melbourne, the Prime Minister, had been on Victoria's side through all this and had pushed this investigation. So now he was in disgrace and had to resign. And he was replaced by a Tory, Robert Peel. And the first thing that Peel did was try to remove from Victoria's household all who were Whig supporters. He tried to order a purge and have them replaced by Tories in what became known as the bedchamber crisis. Victoria stood her ground. She dug her heels in and said, "No, I'm not changing anything for you. This is my household. You can run the country. I'm going to run my own household." At which point, Robert Peel was kind of backed into a corner. And so he resigned and Melbourne returned to power. In 1839, Prince Albert visited Victoria at court, and she realised she liked him even more and proposed to him. And they were married the next year in 1840. And Victoria was never happier. "I never, never spent such an evening," she wrote. "My dearest, dearest, dear Albert, his excessive love and affection gave me feelings of heavenly love and happiness I never could have hoped to have felt before. He clasped me in his arms and we kissed each other again and again. His beauty, his sweetness and gentleness, really, how can I ever be thankful enough to have such a husband? To be called by names of tenderness I have never yet heard used to me before was bliss beyond belief. Oh, this was the happiest day of my life." It was also seemingly one of the happiest nights of her life. One of the things we now know about Victoria is that she had a very healthy sex life and that she really enjoyed being in bed with Albert. Unfortunately for her, she immediately became pregnant, and her marriage with Albert was to be a succession of pregnancies and births, which she hated. She hated being pregnant. She didn't really like babies. She was disgusted by the idea of breastfeeding. She thought newborn babies were ugly. She hated the demands that these children put on her. She hated the fact that she couldn't enjoy herself with Albert as she had used to. But she did her duty. Over the following 17 years, she and Albert had a further 8 children. Albert, named after his father, Edward, Alice, Alfred, Helena, Louise, Arthur, Leopold, and Beatrice. Of course, getting pregnant and having a child made her very popular with the people. "We love nothing more than a royal wedding followed by a royal birth." The other thing that made her popular was being shot at. During her first pregnancy in 1840, she was riding in a carriage through London, that there was the first of 7 assassination attempts on her life. Well, I say assassination attempts. They were attacks. None of them seem to have been political, apart from one, a young Irishman. They seem to be disaffected young men, possibly young men with mental health problems. But also several of them seem to have done it because it was a sure way to get yourself deported to Australia. So if you couldn't afford the fee and you were struggling in England, if you fired a blank pistol at the Queen, you'd get deported. So a few of them seem to have done that. None of them harmed her. I think the first guy that tried to shoot her, Edward Oxford, I think the bullet passed through a bit of her clothing. He was only 18 years old. He was put in a lunatic asylum for 24 years before he was deported. And then as a seemingly ordinary older man, he went to Australia, lived in Melbourne and wrote a book about Melbourne.
So Victoria was kept pregnant through the first 20 years of her reign. And it got worse for her every time. In 1853, when she gave birth to her eighth child, Leopold, her doctors gave her this experimental new form of anaesthetic, chloroform.
She loved it so much, she really started to promote it and used it again for the birth of her ninth child, Beatrice, her last child. Despite opposition from the church, who considered it against biblical teaching, women were born to suffer the pain and danger of childbirth. It's their punishment from God for original sin. And doctors were against it as well because they thought it was dangerous, which it indeed is. So as well as hating the whole process, it seemed that she had postnatal depression, which appeared to have got worse the more pregnancies she had. She was quite sort of angry and petulant. I mean, a lot of people described her all through her life as behaving a bit like a spoilt child. I guess if you come to the throne aged 18, there is going to always be something of the spoilt child about you. But she used to fly into rages with Albert. After her first child, she said that she didn't want a large family. She could not be more unhappy. I'm really upset about it. Her relationship with Albert is interesting. As I say, it's fashionable now to portray it as this great romance, but it was more complicated than that. Albert, very much like Prince Philip during Queen Elizabeth II's reign, felt a bit like a spare prick at a wedding. He didn't really have an official function. He sort of manoeuvred himself into the position of being Victoria's secretary, and he started to deal with all of her royal paperwork, saying, oh, Victoria, you're pregnant again. You can't cope with this. You need to deal with the children. Let me go about running things. He became quite controlling with Victoria. He saw it as helping her and as a way of coping with her emotional outbursts. And she, at least on the surface, acquiesced. She said, oh, I am so lucky to have Albert to do all this for me. But in the end, she only allowed him to be Prince Consort. He never became King Albert. She jealously guarded the fact that she was queen. She was ultimately ruler of the country. And yes, she was allowing him to do the paperwork and a lot of the royal dealings and bureaucracy. But perhaps she had no great desire to do that herself. But she did promote this myth of, like, he was perfect, she was just this silly little woman, and he was helping her out, until it came to the crunch where she would say to him quietly, you must remember, Albert, I'm the queen, not you.
So what was going on the political stage while Victoria was having babies?
We looked in earlier episodes about the introduction of the Corn Laws, this bill that kept corn prices, which is all grain, wheat, barley, corn, rye, whatever, kept prices unnaturally high by putting a huge tax on foreign imports and not allowing them to be sold cheaply, which meant that the homegrown British landowners who were growing their own corn could stay massively wealthy and could control the market. I mean, incredibly unfair, and even in shortages, they wouldn't allow the import of cheap corn from abroad, claiming that it would undermine their system and that we must all buy British. And in 1845, there was a potato blight in Ireland. And because they couldn't get cheap grain to replace the diseased potatoes, it caused a massive famine. Over a million Irish people died, and another million emigrated, largely to America, but also to places around the empire like Australia. And this was the Great Famine. And the Irish started to call Victoria the Famine Queen. It was said, and it was believed for a long time, that Victoria did nothing to help the Irish. But in fact, she did. She personally donated £2,000. I mean, it doesn't seem like a huge amount, but it is the equivalent of millions today, to the British Relief Association, which was more than any other individual donor.
Not that this really lets the English establishment off the hook, or the Anglo-Irish landowners for the long-term treatment of the Irish. But these events inevitably put pressure on Parliament to repeal the Corn Laws.
The Tories, who by now were also known as Conservatives, were inevitably opposed to any form of repeal because most of them were major landowners. But Peel managed to push things through and Victoria supported him. And eventually the Corn Laws were repealed. This drive partly came about because in 1848 there were a huge number of revolutions throughout Europe. The biggest revolutionary wave in European history. There were popular uprisings in Italy, France, Germany, Denmark, Hungary, Sweden, Switzerland, Belgium, Spain, and of course Ireland. This was a sort of second French Revolution, and the French ruler decamped to the United Kingdom. So there was this real push for sort of popular representation to get rid of the monarchy. It wasn't completely successful anywhere, but it did massively shake things up. It's interesting that the one country that didn't really have a revolution at the time was England. There was one in Ireland, which was part of the United Kingdom at the time. But England itself, because it was stable, because people liked Victoria, because she handled things well, because they repealed the Corn Laws and these various reasons, the bourgeoisie were kind of enough in control that nobody wanted a revolution. There was this big revolutionary group known as the Chartists.
And their demands were very reasonable. They had a charter of six main things that they wanted. All males over 21 to have the vote, secret ballots, annual elections, no property ownership qualifications for MPs, and payment for MPs, and equal-sized constituencies. It sounds like a perfectly reasonable template for democracy.
But they were seen as dangerous revolutionaries. Victoria and Albert fled to the Isle of Wight, where Albert had built this house called Osborne House, just in case. But in the end, the Chartist movement came to nothing, and Victoria was able to safely return to London. But Victoria and Albert weathered the storms of 1848. And then in 1852, there was an outbreak of one of these imperial wars in Europe. Victoria, for some reason, had always hated the Russians. She believed that they were trying to take over Europe. They were growing too powerful, even though one of her daughters was married to the Tsar. And what had happened, at least in Eastern Europe, was that there was a bit of a power vacuum because of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which had been such a dominant force in the region. We still have the Turks, who are trying to maintain some degree of control. But Russia, and it's a familiar story, Russia is coming down through what is now Ukraine into the Crimea and wanting to expand further into other territories previously held by the Ottomans. And the British decide to ally with the Turks and try and hold them back. There was a naval blockade of St. Petersburg and there was a land war in the Crimea, the Crimean War, of course.
Famously, we have the Battle of Balaclava, the Charge of the Light Brigade, the Battle of Alma, the Battle of Inkerman, and the Siege of Sevastopol.
All of these things going on. Not a glorious war for anybody, particularly the British. Achieved very little. Perhaps told the Russians, be a little bit careful, don't just think you can go wherever you want. We managed to create a heroic myth out of a great disaster, which the British are very good at. Charge of the Light Brigade being the prime example.
Sticking with the wider world stage for a moment and jumping ahead, the next major conflict was in India.
As I say, the East India Company had been running India, but in 1857 there was a huge uprising, being called various things, being called the Indian Mutiny, the Indian Rebellion. Whatever it was the native Indians saying, we don't really like this situation, thank you very much. And they rose and fought with the British East India Company. At which point, Parliament, with the blessing of the Queen, decided that they would take over the running of India. So a large British army was sent over. The locals were inevitably defeated, and India formally became part of the British Empire. The Queen hated the violence on both sides. She wrote of her feelings of horror and regret at the result of what she called this bloody civil war, rather than this bloody invasion. And she sort of had this idea of like, well, now that the British Empire is running things, everything will be all right. We can settle it down. We can make it all nice and British. We won't have any more of these civil wars, and they can benefit from our civilizing influence. Back home, Prince Albert was continuing with his plan to make the royal family appear just like everyone else and to sort of domesticate Victoria. As well as the house they had built on the Isle of Wight, Albert built a new house for the royal family in Balmoral in Scotland. And it became the favourite haunt of Queen Victoria, just as it was for Queen Elizabeth II 100 years later. And in later life, Victoria would spend at least 4 months of every year at Balmoral, and she sort of disappeared from sight up there after Albert died. But at this point in our story, he is still alive and kicking. She's been sort of slightly infantilized by Albert. He's done that thing of, oh, you let me look after this. I'll pay the bills. Don't you worry your pretty little head about it. And the royal household even had a nickname for Victoria that they would use behind her back. They called her Eliza, a little bit how Queen Elizabeth II was nicknamed Brenda. So as I said, Albert had this idea of trying to make the royal family ordinary. And this is one of the great things that Victoria and Albert did, and it seemed to be largely on Albert's instigation. He said, we must appear to be ordinary people to the public. We must appear to be like them. We must go out and meet them. We must do things with them. He organised this great exhibition in 1851, where they built this huge, great palace of glass, the original Crystal Palace. He did all these things to connect the royal family with people, and it went very well. But as I say, Victoria had to be a little bit subservient to him. He was extremely bright. He was considered very brainy. And Victoria would always say, oh, I'm so stupid, I know nothing. But she demanded his undivided attention, nevertheless. And there's a suspicion that he was keeping her pregnant over and over again, because as long as she was pregnant, she was sidelined. She would have to go into confinement after a birth for many weeks. And, you know, once she was nursing and suffering from her depression, she was rendered fairly powerless. But after the birth of her last child, Princess Beatrice, the doctors advised her that she really shouldn't get pregnant again. And she came out with this line, which is one of the clues to her sex life, where she said to her doctor, oh, Sir James, can I have no more fun in bed? In 1861, the Duchess of Kent, Victoria's mother, died. And when Victoria started going through her papers and her letters and the things she'd written to and about Princess Victoria when she was a child, she realised that her mother had done it because she loved Victoria, not because she hated her. Perhaps she was showing it in the wrong way, but Victoria got very upset that she had ostracised her mother so much. Perhaps this gloomy feeling, this depression, was compounded by the fact that Albert, her beloved husband, was falling ill in some kind of stomach troubles. Things seemed to be exacerbated by problems with Victoria's eldest son, Edward, who was generally known as Bertie, the Prince of Wales, who was very badly behaved. He'd been having a very open affair with an Irish actress, which was pretty scandalous, and Albert tried to wade in and sort it out, and Victoria said, oh, it's the stress of this that's making him ill. I mean, in fact, it was the illness inside him that was making him ill. Nobody's quite sure what it was. The royal doctor, William Jenner, understood these things, diagnosed it as typhoid fever, and that was what went on the death certificate, which was written soon after. Victoria forbade them from carrying out an autopsy because maybe they would have found something else that had killed him. There is speculation that it might have been Crohn's disease or kidney failure or even some form of abdominal cancer. But as I say, there was no autopsy. And the Queen was thrown into terrible terrible grief. Officially, you went into mourning anyway, but she sort of went into mourning for about 40 years. She completely withdrew from public affairs, dressed in black, didn't connect with her people. She didn't connect with her parliament. She stayed in Windsor or Balmoral, very rarely at Buckingham Palace. Prince Albert's room in Windsor Castle, the Blue Room, was kept exactly as it was the day he died. And the servants every day would put out fresh clothing for him and hot water for him to wash and shave. Fresh flowers, and they made sure his pen was filled with ink and ready on his blotting paper. And this continued until Victoria died. She became known as the Widow of Windsor. She had always had a tendency towards comfort eating, and her weight increased, which made her even less fond of the idea of appearing in public. And in 1864, a wag stuck a notice to the railings of Buckingham Palace saying, "These commanding premises to be let or sold in consequence of the late occupant's declining business." And this was the period that Victoria grew closer and closer to her manservant in Scotland, John Brown. And there were people saying, "Oh, this is a love affair. I bet he's banging her in secret." And some people were even saying, "Oh, they secretly married." And satirists in print started referring to her as Mrs. Brown.
The two of them were painted together by Sir Edwin Landseer, which was seen as pretty scandalous at the time. But he does seem to have been a positive influence on Victoria.
He was a very, very ordinary working class man. And it's quite a thing these days, as a way of dealing with depression, is to reconnect with nature, to go on long walks in the countryside, to enjoy the natural world. And that's what John Brown did for Victoria. And he helped her get over this crippling depression. She outlived John Brown, and after his death, she started to write a biography of him. But she was dissuaded by her private secretary, Sir Henry Ponsonby, and the manuscript was destroyed.
So Victoria has withdrawn from public life, but the business of running the country still obviously went on.
In 1867, a Reform Act was finally passed, which doubled the electorate so that many more urban working men were allowed to vote. And the editor of The Economist, Walter Bagshot, wrote a book about the English Constitution, which was a sort of primer for monarchs. And it was also heavily taken up by American presidents. It was how to have a constitutional head of state, saying that the Queen's ceremonial and public role was very important in attracting public loyalty and making the government legitimate. Victoria never seemed to quite fully grasp the implications of this, but it is the blueprint for the monarchy ever since. And interestingly, I think in Victoria's reign, started by Albert, continued by Victoria, we start to get this idea that the main job of the monarchy is to keep it going. That is the most important thing of all. Nothing else matters as much as keeping the monarchy afloat. So Victoria had had differing relationships with the various prime ministers who served under her. After Melbourne, the one that she got on best with was Benjamin Disraeli, who was Jewish and hadn't come from the aristocracy. And he worked out how to charm Victoria. "Everyone likes flattery," he said. "And when you come to royalty, you should lay it on with a trowel." He was very good at dealing with Victoria, of sort of almost flirting with her, of letting her think she was getting her way. He called her his fairy. And he said that the best way of managing the spoilt child queen was through flattery and by humouring her. Because in his words, she was both willful and whimsical. But Disraeli didn't last that long as Prime Minister. He was replaced by Gladstone, who came and went a lot through the Victorian era. And each time he was older and more mad, as Victoria described him. And she hated talking to him because he talked to her not as a woman, but as a public meeting. He was forever speechifying to her and mansplaining.
So Disraeli and Gladstone were great rivals, constantly fighting for pole position. Disraeli was Tory and is credited for creating modern conservatism. And Gladstone was a Whig, a liberal.
He was the one pushing for all the reforms in representation and curbing the powers of the monarch, which is probably why Victoria disliked him so intensely. Disraeli and Gladstone, in their different ways, urged Victoria to engage more closely with what was going on, which helped rehabilitate her with her people. The other thing was, as I said, that people kept taking pot shots at her while she was out and about. And each time she became more popular.
And it really helped if she'd been through a period of people saying, where is she? What's she doing? She goes out in public, someone shoots at her, and she's like, hurrah for the Queen. She said, it was worth being shot at to see how much one is loved. It even worked for Bertie, the Prince of Wales. Someone shot at him, and his popularity went through the roof. In 1887, the whole of the British Empire celebrated her golden jubilee. She had a huge banquet to which 50 kings and princes were invited. She then went on a very popular procession around London, and the public was loving her again.
They also, for the most part, loved the idea of the British Empire, of Britannia ruling the waves, of Great Britain being the most powerful and glorious nation on earth. So when she was officially declared Empress of India, there were more celebrations.
She very much liked the idea of empire, and she hired two Indian Muslims as waiters, one of whom was a man called Abdul Karim. And he became in some ways a sort of replacement for John Brown. She seemed to really like him, and he would teach her all about Islam and the workings of India. And she started treating him more as a friend than a servant, which appalled her family and the royal court. Abdul Karim was accused of spying for the Muslim Patriotic League and biasing the Queen against Hindus. And she told them all to piss off, basically, and said she was quite happy with him. And she kept him on in her service until she died, when he went back to India with a lifelong pension.
10 years after her Golden Jubilee, she had her Diamond Jubilee in 1897. And as I say, there's footage of this on YouTube if you want to take a look. And not long after, in 1901, at the age of 81, Queen Victoria died of, well, of old age, which is still often put on death certificates. It was probably a cocktail of things, perhaps a stroke, cardiac arrest, pneumonia. And sometimes old people, when their health is declining, and she'd been suffering from cataracts and rheumatism and was unable to walk following a fall, and she was prey to all the other things that plague old age. And in the end, sometimes people just decide to stop. They decide they've had enough. Interestingly, Victoria, so famous for dressing in black for half her life, was buried in white, her coffin filled to the brim with all sorts of sentimental items. A plaster cast of Prince Albert's hand, her wedding ring, another ring given to her by John Brown, and a lock of his hair and a photograph of him, secretly put in so that her son Edward, Bertie, wouldn't know. And there were piles of jewellery, cut flowers, some Scottish heather, all sorts of other photographs and papers and knick-knacks. It's not hard to find memorials to her, streets named after her, whole cities, a state in Australia, pubs, statues, waterfalls, public buildings, and of course Albert was immortalised as well. Victoria commissioned the bizarre and rather gaudy Albert Memorial that sits opposite the Royal Albert Hall, this huge concert venue next to Hyde Park in London. So please make sure you keep listening, because after the break, I'm going to be talking to the brilliant Alex Churchill about this formidable woman.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome back. My guest today is the historian and presenter Alex Churchill, one of the creators of the podcast History Hack. She also writes extensively about the First World War and the Second World War, and wrote the chapter on Queen Victoria in Ian Dale's recent history of the British monarchy, Kings and Queens, 1200 years of English and British monarchs. So Queen Victoria, whose choice was it? Did Ian come to you? Did you go to Ian? How did you end up writing the section on Queen Victoria in the book?
I came in quite late because I didn't know him until we did a History Hack. And really, the only thing left was Edward IV. And I was like, all right, there's some fun in there. There's Wars of the Roses and stuff. And then someone dropped out of Charles II. And I was like, can I do him? And he was like, yeah, sure. And then someone let him down on Queen Victoria. And then I'm back in my wheelhouse. So I was like, I have an amazing friend who will do an amazing Charles II for you. But can I please have Victoria? And he just went. By that point, I think I'd helped him find like 10 people for that book. He just went, yes, OK.
So that is a big area of interest for you, that era.
I like to do after the bewigged douchebags. So after they stop wearing the frizzy white wigs. Yes. Is when my interest starts. I'm a little bit out of my depth in the 1840s and 50s, and then, yeah, my stuff.
So sort of went coming into what we recognise as the modern world in a way, really.
Yeah, and then I completely lose interest after George VI because it doesn't feel like history.
So what is your take on Victoria?
If you read the chapter that I wrote, that our perception of her has been skewed over the years, and it's getting much better now, but by men. So if I tell you that the first two people to publish any of her papers, it was right after she died, were two homosexual men who didn't like women. I don't know, like, I have this thing that I think they don't understand her and they don't care to understand her. And I feel like it's because it was Arthur Benson who was quite famous, and it was Lord Esher, who was famous for all sorts of reasons, and some of them are incredibly sordid and yuck. But he actually said, I didn't include anything by any letters that she wrote to women because women have got nothing interesting to say to each other. So when I got cast for this, I was like, right, you bugger, I'm coming for you. So I was like, because I only had 6,000 words, and I thought, I'm going to write the whole thing. I'm going to make it your worst nightmare. I'm going to make it all about her femininity, about how being a woman impacted her on the throne, about her pregnancies. I'm going to write about childbirth and really freak you out. And then I wrote about, you know, this stunning revelation that she was a widow at 42 who quite liked sex, and she may have gone and found it somewhere else afterwards. So I literally went out of my way to get my own back on a dead man. And that's how my chapter came about.
There does seem to be in this sort of perception of her at the time, and as you say, in the books written, that she was a sort of hysterical woman.
Oh, always. Yeah, I've been accused of being that this week. Like, you can't disagree with some men without them, like, the first place they go is, oh, women. And it's like, hang on, no. You didn't agree with what I said about one aspect of the First World War, and now all women are hysterical. Like, that defence doesn't work anymore, guys. I think we know that. Although, I will say, if women are being hysterical and ridiculous, just like men, you can tell them that without everybody piling on you. You should be able to say, enough.
Yes, yes. Well, where do we start with all that? I guess probably the most controversial, but is this idea of, did she have a sex life after Albert? Because as you say, she explicitly told people that she enjoyed being in bed with Albert. Mm. And yes, as you say, she was widowed at 40. So where do you stand on that?
So a woman who has 9 children, 2 of them after she's been told not to have any more children because it might kill her. Because, all right, in fairness, she is quite hysterical when she's pregnant. But then if I'd been knocked up 9 times, I'd be quite angry as well with my husband. And we're supposed to believe that that was it and that she just never had sex again. And I emphatically believe that is not the case. I do think she had a sexual relationship with John Brown, and so did the daughter of her doctor, James Reed, or a royal doctor who was. So he was eventually sent out to sort of intercept and destroy some letters for Edward VII that were apparently quite revealing in that. But James Reed's daughter emphatically believed as well that they did have a sexual relationship. I don't know if they got married or whatever. Mm. Like that. Maybe that's just another layer to sort of rumour in that. But I do believe they had a sexual relationship, and I'm pleased for her.
Well, it's such a shame that her children went through and basically censored all her letters and her journals, didn't they?
Well, Beatrice was the worst. So Beatrice was the youngest daughter. And like traditionally, the youngest daughter would have stayed at home. And eventually she got quite sad about not having a family of her own. So they cut a deal where so Beatrice could get married and have children, but her husband had to come and live with them and the mother-in-law. And Victoria wasn't to lose her companion. So they were very close. And when she died, Beatrice took 122 volumes, so 70 years of diaries, rewrote them in her own hand, editing the bits she thought were unpalatable. And George V, who was Prince of Wales by then, begged her not to do it. And she burned the originals anyway. And I think she thought she was doing what her mother would have wanted and the right thing. But yeah, we are so much poorer for it. And then all of this nonsense about like the John Brown stuff, Edward VII had that burned. I don't know why you would bother. He also had other stuff destroyed from Abdul Karim as well. And it's sad, but we have what we have and we have to make do with it.
I guess we probably have more stuff about Victoria than any previous monarch, though. I mean, this guy you mentioned before, Reginald Brett, the second Viscount Esher, who used to push Victoria around in a wheelchair towards the end, he was kind of allowed in first, wasn't he? To look through all the royal papers that Victoria had left behind.
Someone said to him, someone should probably do something with all of the crap in this cupboard or in this room. That's all the letters. It's basically the Royal Archives. Because everyone's just been chucking boxes in there for years and no one knows what's going on. So he actually, the reason he was into it all is because he'd gone in and started trying to sort it out. And so really the Royal Archives, when you go there, the bulk of their material is sort of coming from the Georgians onwards.
You started out by saying how our views of Queen Victoria have changed for the better. And there's been an emphasis recently on her great love affair with Albert. But I mean, he just seemed to have been quite controlling. And there's a suspicion that he kept her out of the way a bit by making sure she was either pregnant or nursing for 20 years.
There's a really odd dynamic at play, I think. And I don't know if it's sinister on his part, but the fact that he was professionally subservient to his wife and always would be, no matter what he did. He was, I mean, whether you agree, like his parenting style is horrific and he deserves a slap for it. And it caused mayhem in later years. But he was also phenomenally bright. And some of the stuff he did do, like going out, I mean, he went to Birmingham, which was unheard of in the 1850s. They'll lynch you. He was told they will lynch you and kill you because you were a royal. And they didn't. And he went, well, I'm going anyway because I need to meet people. Like nobody ever meets us. That's the problem. Like they think we sit here and we aren't interested in them. So really, conceptually, Albert is at the root of everything the royal family is today with all of the charity work and the sort of middle class values and everything. So he is not useless for it, but him understanding when he needed to back down. She was fiercely jealous about her power because she'd almost had it taken away from her by her mother and her mother's lover.
Victoria's controller, Sir John Conroy.
And she wasn't going to give it up. So there were screaming rows, but Victoria is also very conscious about with the controlling thing in the family sphere, she lets him because it's like, I have to swat you down in the room, but in the house, you are the husband and you will have the power kind of thing. So,
and I mean, she seemed to be forever saying women shouldn't have power. She seemed to have been very against.
Yeah, but this is why I love her.
Separation.
Yeah, but not for her. She can have it. She's queen, not anyone.
But didn't she also sort of say a woman shouldn't really be queen?
Possibly at some stage. She's brilliant because she's not the smartest person in the room. She's not stupid. But she definitely as well is not PR savvy like a royal would be today. But she says some things and you're like, oh, my God, you can't say that. But yeah, in terms of keeping her pregnant, she was only pregnancy three in the first sort of 12 years of marriage for three of those years. And I think in the first 5 years, she was pregnant 75% of the time. And obviously because a woman still did confinement then and everything, it did mean for a portion of each pregnancy, she had to hand the reins over to Albert because of course that's who she trusted. And I think it's mixed in with the fact that she hated being pregnant as well. She said it's like being a cow or a dog. And the fact that not only does she feel shitty, but she's watching him do her job. I think perhaps she probably overreacted more than she actually felt inside because of how she felt in the moment.
And also suffering with postnatal depression as well.
Absolutely, yeah, especially after Bertie. So she got pregnant very quickly with Vicky after being married, and she would always try and ram it home to everyone. Don't get knocked up for the first couple of years because it takes all the fun out of it. And I think she hated the loss of control over her own body, and she would always reference, especially with the first two, I think the first two, and bearing in mind, like, yes, she's queen and yes, she's married and everything, but she's a child, really. She's like 20, yeah. 21. And what's interesting is reading about her railing about the physical effects that having nine children had on her body. Mm. She thinks that pregnancy makes women the slave of their husbands. So yes, she doesn't agree with women's rights broadly, but she does believe that there are aspects of life that are unfair because you are a woman.
Do you know, I mean, was there any thought of using some form of contraception or birth control? Because she was told not to have any more children, wasn't she?
I mean, they were told don't have any more after Arthur, who was number seven. And I know that part of it was around how much she wound herself up when she was pregnant. So by the time another unexpected one comes along with number nine, which is Beatrice, so apparently Albert was not allowed near her because she would fly off into such a rage on the sight of him that they feared it might kill the mother and the child. So he would have to send her notes across the palace, which I think after nine times, she's kind of entitled to be a bit pissy with him. But I don't know that there were any efforts to stop making it happen. But then that's 1858 and he's still alive for a few years after that, but it does stop. So potentially.
There are some quarters that say that Albert seemed to be trying to slowly claw back some power for the monarchy, and that if he'd lived longer, he might have started to undermine this new, very hands-off constitutional monarchy that was evolving.
I'm not sure. His position definitely got stronger. He definitely went from this sort of aimless flailing at the beginning and not knowing where you fit in. And actually, I think, like you see with Prince Philip, figured it out, but not straight away. There was that period at the beginning of his marriage to Elizabeth where what is the point of me? Where do I fit in? It's all about my wife. I'm a nobody. Literally, I could do anything and no one would care, which is not true. But I think that seems to be the reaction that they had. And there's definitely a strengthening in Albert once he gets over that, once he gets over his bitch baby fit and starts to go, right, what change can I affect? And good change as well. So things like that whole domesticity, middle class values thing, that's all Albert. And the royal family sorely needed that because it had been, frankly, a shit show for quite a long time when she came to the throne, because you have the madness of King George. That doesn't look good. Nobody likes Prinny. He's horrible. And then you've got like Victoria's wicked uncles as well. So nobody really has much respect for the royal family. And by sort of seizing this projection of blissful domesticity and sort of no adultery and nonsense and no rampant spending, which was George IV's biggest thing, he's definitely clawing that respect back. As he stepped in more times while she was pregnant, people listened to him more. I don't know that I think he was ever... I haven't researched him independently. I don't know that I believe he was trying to do away with a constitutional monarchy, but I do think, I do understand why people who didn't necessarily like him might have accused him of that, because he definitely grew as a figure towards his death. And he was making a difference, and he was making a good difference in terms of the future of the royal family. And I'm sure there are people at the time that didn't see that.
One of the themes of this series has been comparing royal families of the past with the current royal family, and all of these very minor scandals, royal scandals that we have, that suddenly the likes of the Daily Mail are up in arms saying this is the end of the monarchy, they've got to learn how to behave. Why can't it be like the golden days of Queen Victoria's reign? But there were bigger scandals then, and also she wasn't universally loved through her life, and the idea that, you know, the monarchy was safe and certain, it certainly wasn't. And it's really interesting because it's looked through Victoria's reign, because she didn't have a huge amount of power. There's this idea that she would advise the Prime Minister, she would suggest or whatever. But it seems to be that the royal family spending most of their energies on trying to preserve the royal family and to keep the royal family going, even though no one can really pin down what it's for and what they're supposed to do.
So I mentioned before that I think this is the evolution beginning for the modern royal family, which looks very different to to the days of Victoria's wicked uncles and George III running around with his unfortunate ailment. I think that that really gets rammed home by George V in the First World War.
So Victoria, she's Empress of India, the grandmother of Europe. I mean, but does she actually have any power?
In her head, she has all the power and she is omnipotent. And for me, I think she's the last one that sort of struggles to accept the limitations of her power. I think Edward VII, for all of the many, many things that make me not like that man and the things that are wrong with him, he accepted that and he was savvy about how he interacted with people, especially in foreign policy sphere.
So people, I mean, not all people, but most want a monarchy, but they don't really want the monarchs to do anything. And they want them to behave in a certain way.
My favourite comparison to make between Victoria and Elizabeth II is what society does. And I'm not a raging feminist, but what I do see in both of their reigns is that I don't think it's a coincidence that both of them become deeply unpopular for the period where they're middle-aged women. So they stop being the young, beautiful mother and they get to the menopausal point and everyone's horrible to them for a period. And then they become the lovely old lady. And Elizabeth,
lovely granny. Yeah.
Elizabeth had that. And it was all tied in with the Diana thing. And Victoria had it as well. And hers was all tied in with, there was like a revolutionary wave at the time. But hers, she did go into mourning like we think of her as doing so. But she did come out the other side. She never stopped missing him. And yes, she always wore black. And yes, she had his room the way he left it. But she came back, and I think I make the point in the chapter that Melbourne, from the beginning of her reign, would not have recognised her, and she became stronger as a person and as a force on the throne the older she got after that period. And I think that's the same for Elizabeth II as well. I think on the other side of that very negative period, she became incredibly strong. And I think now if you tell people, well, yeah, you won't remember, but there was a period in the 90s where everyone hated the Queen. They'd be like, what?
Yeah, yeah. And similar reasons of the Victoria thing is you've got to show yourself. You've got to show yourself to the people. You've got to show that you're one of them.
I just find it's like society doesn't know what to do with a middle-aged woman. It's like, well, you're no longer having kids, but you're not a sweet old lady, so what are you? And I have friends that age that have said, like I do, one of the things that is the hardest thing to come to terms with is suddenly feeling anonymous. I just think it's an interesting thing.
Victoria's relationship with her various prime ministers is interesting. The different ways that they dealt with her and that she dealt with them. She obviously really liked and appreciated Melbourne at the beginning, and later on she couldn't stand Gladstone, could she? I mean, she described him as a most disagreeable person, half crazy, arrogant, tyrannical and obstinate, with no knowledge of the world or of human nature. But she had what seems almost like a sort of faux girlish relationship with Disraeli, a bit like what we used to hear about Margaret Thatcher and her cabinet.
That all these old, these Tory grandees would say, oh, she's terribly flirty. I find her terribly sexy. And, you know, there was that, was she using her feminine wiles to get away? Or was it just that she was a woman and they weren't used to speaking to women? I don't know.
Oh, Disraeli was a genius in dealing with her because he didn't treat her like a queen in a period where she's coming to terms with being a widow. And he treated her like a woman and she loved it. Gladstone, she thinks, is the devil. It's interesting, like they're polarised. Like Melbourne, obviously, she adored, and that's kind of a, she needed Melbourne. She needed someone like that. And this is, I think it's the best example of the fact that she can't quite wrap her head around the constitutional monarchy aspect of it, in that she has favourites. Like she causes that massive ruckus at the beginning of her reign because Peel can't take over because she won't let him have the tradition of putting his choice of ladies in the bedchamber, which is just not done. But she does it because she's an impetuous child at the time. I think Disraeli managed her very, very well. And I think she's not an idiot. She knew she was being managed, but she enjoyed it. She enjoyed the interaction. And again, Edward VII destroyed the letters. We don't know the nature of that, but I do know that when I was doing the research for the chapter on her, including Albert, I read that she has never been more grief-stricken her entire life than when Disraeli died. And they were not saying, except for Albert, they were saying never more distraught.
Really?
She lost him. So I think there was a deep connection there that I don't think was necessarily sexual. Probably they both got it. They got that he was flirting with her. She knew she was being flirted with, but she liked being flirted with. So she was like, sure, I like this. I like this interaction. He doesn't treat me like everyone else treats me.
What was her attitude towards the wars, the Crimean War and the Boer War? I mean, in reading about her, you sort of have, well, it seems to be that Parliament is entirely engaged in doing these wars and she's sort of almost watching from the sidelines.
Yeah, I definitely get that feeling with the Crimean War. There's a great quote from her when someone tells her all about Florence Nightingale and she says, oh, she sounds wonderfully efficient. Can't we put her at the War Office? So she's obviously not impressed with what she's seeing. With the Boer War, the whole sort of scramble for Africa thing, that obviously she's quite an old lady by this point and she has the views that you'd expect a woman of her age to have at the time who has been declared empress. But she's not delusional about what imperialism means. She knows that you don't get an empire the size of the British Empire by talking to people. She knows it's by force and she's not squeamish about that at all. And I think that obviously the cancelling people find that hard to deal with, but she's definitely very pragmatic about how it all works, but incredibly proud of the British Empire as well.
And she certainly seemed to have believed that idea that, well, we're doing good, we're making their lives better, we're bringing civilization. There didn't seem to be any doubt about that.
No, I think as well, if Disraeli's the one schooling you on everything that's happening, he was the arch jingoist, so that's who she talks to. So, and that's whose opinion she values massively. So it doesn't surprise me that she would respond to the idea of empire like that at all. But she also, as well, I think it's really important to say that she's not a racist. She doesn't believe white people are any better than the subjects they rule over. Even if she thinks that we are improving their lives and taking Christianity out there and all these traditional concepts of imperialism, the one thing you can say about Victoria, about Edward, about George V, you can't say it about the Duke of Windsor, he was a racist, George VI as well, is that I can find you abundant evidence that actually racism, they didn't like it. There's for Edward VII, I mean, he actually at one point witnessed some and said it made him utterly sick. It repulsed him that someone with white skin might think they were a better class of human than someone that wasn't white. And in Victoria, like, she absolutely loved Abdul Karim. And this is a different kind of, this isn't a sexual kind of obsession. She loves to look at him. She probably loved to flirt a little with him, but more than anything, she loves what he gives her, which is making an old lady who's losing her sight and feeling more and more irrelevant in the world feel like she's learning something new and getting out into the world. He would make chicken curry for her and he taught her bits of Hindi and he taught her all about Indian culture. He was just a clerk. He wasn't a genius. He wasn't brought over to be a tutor. He was brought over as eye candy, imperial eye candy for an event. And he stayed and she adored his company and she and her family hated it and they hated him because she nursed him when he was ill at one point. And for her, that barrier sort of vanished with him between queen and subject. And I think it gave her something to really enjoy at the end of her life.
I guess the thing that's changed most in my lifetime in perceptions of Queen Victoria is seeing her as a person, as a human being, and not just this great archetypal thing of Queen Victoria.
Yeah, people say, like, we are not amused. She never said that. There's no way she ever said that. She was constantly amused. I think I put a list in the chapter. I said she had a rotten, dirty laugh that she would let out. She loved dogs. She loved food. She was greedy and she knew it and she didn't care. She'd inherit a pseudo Scottish accent every time she crossed the border that everyone just had to pretend wasn't happening. She had a phobia of bishops in their regalia. It creeped her out. Like, she is so wonderfully human. And I feel like we're kind of taking that back for her now. And she can be a nightmare and wind people up and rub them the wrong way. Like Gladstone at one point said, like, the beginning of her reign, we couldn't get anything out of her when I first came along because she was mourning. And now I can't shut her up. Like, she's got an opinion on everything. I love that she fully gets in touch with the authorities because she's convinced that she knows why they haven't found Jack the Ripper as well.
Now, I have one last question. The one question that everyone wants to ask is about Prince Albert.
No, unfortunately, I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that Queen Victoria benefited particularly from that aspect of the body amendment. So is that a polite way of putting it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's an urban legend, and it comes from a Hollywood director who was obsessed with piercings, and maybe he just got a little excited one day making stuff up, but no.
Well, thank you so much, Alex, for talking to us about Queen Victoria. And just to remind listeners, if they want to read your chapter, that's in the book edited by Ian Dale, Kings and Queens, 1200 Years of English and British Monarchs.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And also log into Alex's Substack and check out her podcast, History Hack. In the next episode, we'll be looking at the notorious cigar-smoking playboy Bertie, the Prince of Wales, who becomes Edward VII and ushers in the all-too-brief Edwardian era. I think it's fairly clear that Alex is not a fan of him, but I'll leave you to make your mind up. Was he a total rotter or a colourful interlude between Queen Victoria and the dark days of the First World War?
Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willy Willy Harry Stee was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willy Willy Harry Stee, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.